Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Skagway's history is linked with the railroad. So, you know, losing operations on the railroad would definitely have a significant impact.
Rail workers in Skagway consider a strike in the middle of tourist season. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 28th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, the Kasilof River is open for dip netting season.
What does it feel like when you finally catch a fish in your net?
Super exciting. Yeah, super, super exciting.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience. Your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
State regulators are proposing a $900,000 fine to punish ConocoPhillips for a gas leak last year at its Alpine drill site on the North Slope. The oil company was drilling a well in March of 2022 when workers noticed gas emissions hundreds of feet away, including from fractures in the surface of the gravel drill pad. A concrete barrier intended to contain well pressure had cracked. The Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission later determined that Conoco had underestimated the gas production potential of one zone the well went through. And then, just before the underground blowout, workers had pumped in fluids that briefly overpressurized the well beyond allowable limits. Compounding the company's faults, the operator failed to submit regulatory paperwork. The incident was a black eye for ConocoPhillips, and it occurred just as the Biden administration was considering whether to allow the company to develop its highly controversial Willow project just 30 miles away. The leak at Alpine continued for days before workers got control of it. It took more than 3 weeks to stop the flow at the source. The total amount emitted was roughly equivalent to the annual gas consumption of a small city subdivision. A company spokeswoman says Conoco is reviewing the investigative findings and proposed fine. Meanwhile, for the second time this summer, Anchorage officials are clearing out a big swath of public land where a lot of people without homes are camping. Anchorage doesn't have enough shelter space for the soon-to-be-displaced campers, which leaves a large vacant lot at the edge of downtown as a likely space people will resettle. Alaska Public Media's Jeremy Shea reports that its neighbors are bracing for the encampment to swell again, along with public safety and nuisance issues.
The city posted notices here at the Mountain View Snow Dump and Davis Park across the street a week ago. Crude shelters made of tarps and tents and scavenged materials are among the trees, surrounded by bike parts, wet clothes, blankets, tote bins, shopping carts, and piles of garbage.
So you have any idea what you'll do when they come through to try to clear people out?
Really?
This is a really common response from unsheltered people getting displaced. This time, the military is involved. The encampments being targeted are on properties that the city leases from Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, just outside the base's fence line.
And the terms of the lease are that we keep it free of trash and camps.
Mike Braniff is the head of the city's Parks and Recreation Department, which is responsible for cleaning up lots of these unofficial campsites. Braniff says every time the city clears campsites, it's safety-driven. He says the military was patient and understanding, but that changed recently.
And then we learned about a week ago, 10 days ago maybe, that people had been coming and going onto the fenced active portion of the military base, and they expect us to take action.
Base officials were not available to answer questions on tape. In an email, base spokesperson Aaron Eaton did not confirm or deny Braniff's statements. Eaton said the base and city worked together on security issues. She said the base plays a role in national security and that base security must respond immediately to trespassing. The American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska says it plans to file appeals on behalf of some of the impacted campers. Its lawyers already have appeals pending for 3 people who were camping on city land in Midtown. The city pushed most campers out of that area ahead of a three-day music festival in mid-June, citing public safety concerns about how the campers and concertgoers might interact. The ACLU thinks both camp clearing actions are illegal in light of a 2018 federal court ruling that says it is unconstitutional to punish homeless people for camping in public spaces when there isn't enough shelter. ACLU spokesperson Megan Barker says the city is just moving the problem without meaningful solutions.
They're just continuing to clear areas and make it even harder for people who don't have resources. We don't really know where they are expected to go.
Rob Couples thinks he does know. The large, city-owned vacant lot along 3rd Avenue, across the street from a block of vacation rental properties he owns. Couples has been very vocal about recurring vandalism, property damage, safety, and quality of life issues he attributes to the encampment. Couples hops down from an excavator. He's running around a small house he's renovating for the business.
I'm doing dirt work around the perimeter of my property in preparation for construction of 350 linear feet of fencing.
On one wall, he scrubbed the wooden siding down to remove a graffiti tag. Several windows are broken. He says someone shot them out recently with a BB gun. He says the fencing is his top priority right now. He's bracing for a third wave of people to come to the neighborhood. The first wave came when the city shut down its winter shelters, the second when the Midtown site was cleared. He walks the encampment regularly, handing out trash bags and trying to build some relationships. He says the number of tents and RVs and cars have ballooned. He used to keep a precise count, but it's too hard to do now. He estimates there are more than 100 tents and 200 people. Mayor Dave Bronson and his senior staff visited the site on Monday. In a video, he announced a cleanup effort.
We're here to remove abandoned cars, tires, garbage. This simply has to be done. The city is not going to turn out to be Seattle or Portland or San Francisco.
Bronson's team intends to increase police patrols and hire a contractor to install a fence around the site. Couples cautiously welcome the mayor's announcement.
My fear is that these things that he intends to implement will not be here in time. Well, I know they won't be. They will not be here in time before this third wave hits East 3rd Avenue.
Couples says down the road, he would consider legal action if there's no improvement. In Anchorage, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Skagway's railroad workers are voting on whether to authorize a strike. The workers' union says it's seeking wages that keep up with inflation, affordable health care, and no job cuts. As KTOO's Katie Anastas reports, the dispute is playing out in the middle of a busy post-pandemic tourist season.
The White Pass and Yukon Route is one of the most popular tourist attractions in Southeast Alaska. The scenic and historic train ride runs from Skagway into Canada's Yukon Territory. It's the largest private employer in town. Engineers, conductors, and brakemen on the Alaska side are hoping to reach an agreement with White Pass that boosts wages and avoids job cuts. And this week, they're voting whether to go on strike if needed. Skagway Mayor Andrew Cremata says a strike could cause major disruptions for the cruise industry.
More than half of the passengers that come through Skagway ride the train. And, you know, Skagway's history is linked with the railroad. So, you know, losing operations on the railroad would definitely have a significant impact.
Jason Geiler chairs the union that represents the workers. He says he's worried about permanent cuts to brakeman positions. Brakemen are one of the three workers on the train at all times.
Having three people on board a train is critical when you're carrying, you know, 600 plus guests on board every single one of these trains that travel up and down the mountain on a daily basis.
Even if the union votes to authorize a strike, it wouldn't happen right away. There are still several steps in the negotiating process that would have to happen first. The union's previous contract ended in 2017, and wages and healthcare costs are other key issues for the union as it negotiates the new one. Geiler couldn't share specifics on the wage increases proposed by both parties, but he says the union recognizes the company's lost profit during COVID. He says the union is strictly looking to increase wages to keep up with inflation. Mayor Cremata says that's important for Skagway residents.
It's expensive to live here. The pandemic and the last couple of years, I've seen prices at the grocery store double, if not more. So it concerns me to think that, you know, people who live in this community may not be able to afford to live in this community anymore.
White Pass is owned by an investment group that includes the Carnival Corporation and Ketchikan-based Survey Point Holdings. Executive Director Tyler Rose says he can't comment on ongoing negotiations.
White Pass and Yukon Route is committed to working towards the resolution of these negotiations in the interests of all involved.
The union is set to meet with company representatives and a mediator on Friday morning to continue negotiating. In Juneau, I'm Katie Anastas.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, kids attending summer camp at the Alaska Botanical Garden go on an insect safari.
Did you find any stink bugs here?
Yes, I found one on the table and I picked it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
Dip netting on the Kisilof River opened to Alaska anglers on Sunday, and this season, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game is expanding the boundaries of the dip net site to give anglers more room during the fishery's six-week opening. That says the Kisilof River continues to see big sockeye runs and more anglers who are following the fish. KDLL's Sabine Pooks has more.
Covered head to toe in sand-splattered rain jackets and waders, Gail Heineman and Grady Taylor of Anchorage are braving the unseasonably brisk June weather Tuesday to try their luck at their favorite dip net spot.
Yeah, we've been coming here for decades. Don't ask me how many.
Tents line the shore of the beach at the mouth of the Kisilof River. Families stand by four-wheelers and coolers full of fresh-caught sockeye salmon. And aside from the squawking seagulls, it's a relatively quiet scene for a dipnet fishery.
Not as crazy as the Kenai gets sometimes, and not as busy, it seems like. The conditions aren't as challenging usually, so it's just more laid back.
The Kenai River remains the state's most popular dipnet spot, but that location has actually seen a drop in popularity in recent years. The Kisilof dipnet fishery, meanwhile, is on the rise. Last year, personal use fishermen harvested almost 160,000 sockeye from the river, nearly double the sockeye harvest a decade ago. At the same time, the Kisilof's seeing record numbers of sockeye pass through Fish and Game's sonar. Last year, the run came close to 1 million fish. And that trend seems poised to continue. Anglers on day three of the dipnet fishery say the fishing is, so far, so good. Heineman and Taylor fished just two tides and have already caught their limit.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty darn good.
They've been coming to the Kisilof since before there was an organized parking lot and rows of porta-potties and trash bins.
Come down here and there'd be a dozen people at most.
I mean, people used to make their own nets. You didn't used to be able to buy nets at Costco.
Still, even with the lots and the porta-potties and the Costco fishing nets, they say it's a relatively peaceful spot. Heineman suspects the fishery will be more popular this year as a personal use set net fishery on the Kisilof is closed due to low king salmon counts on the Kenai River. First-time dipnetter Eva Franklin is a fan so far. She just caught her third sockeye salmon of the day.
Our third fish today, but our dad caught four fish last night.
That's true.
Franklin's camping at the beach with her family from Eagle River. They say it's a more family-friendly spot than the Kenai, and a nice change of scenery from the Anchorage area.
Even though we wait a lot, catching the fish is a fun part.
What does it feel like when you finally catch a fish in your net?
Like, super exciting. Yeah, super, super exciting.
Franklin says she's already hooked.
I'm gonna fish my whole life. It'll be super fun.
The Kisilof dipnet season started Sunday and goes through August 7th. Fish and Game extended the boundaries of the site up to the Sterling Highway Bridge on the Kisilof River. The Kenai dipnet fishery, meanwhile, opens July 10th. In Kisilof, I'm Sabine Pooks.
On the central Kenai Peninsula, plastic is getting a second life as lumber, thanks to a local collections program and innovative recycling project. KDLL's Riley Board visited the mobile facility that turns waste into wood and has this story.
At the Diamond M Ranch in Kenai, amid a field of cows, a mobile machine is turning post-consumer plastic into usable lumber. Large white bags sit in the pasture, stuffed with milk jugs, clamshell containers, and industrial-looking materials.
But as you can see here, just lots and lots of plastics.
Jerry Miller is the plant manager. Today, he's overseeing work at the site, which has been set up in Kenai for a couple weeks. This facility is the project of Patrick Simpson, an Anchorage-based engineer who won a competitive EPA grant to turn plastic into lumber. He has a mobile operation based out of a 53-foot trailer and travels between different communities that stockpile post-consumer plastics, grinding and melting them into a new form. On site, Miller explains the process. First, the plastic heads up a repurposed wood conveyor and into a grinder, where it's processed into small plastic chips. The bulk of that plastic comes from industrial oil operations on the North Slope.
You see all these things here, it looks like big caps. Those are drill pipe cap protectors from different drilling organizations. They go on to protect the threads on the pipe, and what they do is when they're done with their useful life, they clean them and process them where we can actually get them and grind them up.
Miller says it's a high-grade, high-density plastic that makes the perfect base for their product. Those caps comprise 75% of the lumber. The other 25% is post-consumer plastic, collected from the community in a popular program that began last summer. Simpson collected numbers 1, 2, 4, and 5 plastics at drop sites in Soldotna, Seward, and Homer. That publicly recycled plastic can be a bit of a problem for the grinder, called a granulator. Miller says even a little bit of metal can damage the blade.
Actually touch each and every piece to make sure the machine doesn't go get gummed up with metal because it'll damage the cutting blades.
In the granulator, the plastic is turned into fine, relatively uniform shards of plastic, and the chips get put back into those giant sacks. Miller runs his hands through the material. This bag is all green, thanks to a surplus of emerald thread protectors. Other common colors are purple and black. Once the plastic is ground, it's time for the extruder.
You can think of the extruder just like stuffing sausage casings.
The machine heats the material to 425 degrees. Then it pushes the melted plastic into steel molds that approximate traditional lumber sizes. Lots of 2x4s, 2x6s, and some custom orders for a federal agency. It takes only a few minutes to fill each mold. Then the plastic cools inside the steel and is unmolded in perfect green plastic logs. That lumber, called grizzly wood, is more durable outside than wood and denser, which Miller says makes it a great candidate for picnic tables and industrial sources.
It's just the nice thing about it is it's not going to rot.
Miller says the overall process is pretty efficient.
The nice thing about the grizzly wood as well, one other benefit is, just like when you're building anything, you have your cutoffs. What do you do with those? Most people throw them in the fireplace or whatever. With this, you can bring it back, we can regrind it, and make more wood out of it.
This processing facility means that Kenai area residents can bring their plastics to Diamond M Ranch. But overall, the plastic collection program is still in a state of flux. Simpson put that program on pause in April when he ran out of storage containers. Now, he's on the hunt for a baler to reduce the sizes of the collected plastics and a permanent year-round collection site. He says he hopes to reopen the program in September, but that's not guaranteed. The mobile lumber setup will be in Kenai for a couple more weeks. Then it's headed off to Midtown Anchorage in July, Seward in August, and Palmer for the winter. In Kenai, I'm Riley Board.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Quality childcare creates futures for families, children, and the state's economy. When children are safe, engaged, and learning, parents can work and everyone has a better outcome. To learn more about finding quality childcare in Alaska, visit threadalaska.org. This message sponsored by Thread.
One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support.
If you were one of the hundreds of people celebrating Juneteenth during Anchorage's downtown festivities this month, you likely ran across Jasmine Smith. Smith is an entrepreneur and was the coordinator for the Juneteenth celebration. Earlier this month, Smith was named a finalist by national black media network The Griot for their inaugural Hero Award. The award spotlights African Americans across the country who work on improving the black community and uplifting their culture. As a black woman in a state with a relatively small black community, Smith says she was surprised by her nomination.
When I was first called, I thought it was spam, and so I didn't answer at first. And then when I talked with them, I was like, oh, this is real. And honestly, it feels good. I think from a standpoint of like being in Alaska and being of color and sometimes being of color in spaces where there's like not a lot of people of color, trying to amplify and like uplift is a little bit harder. And so the fact that someone saw that, you know, all the way in Alaska, that's really special to me.
What do you mean being in those spaces?
Well, I think when you think about like these kind of awards and like cultural places and community, I think it's easier to uplift your culture when there's more people there helping you do it, right? Like if you live in a space or a community that is predominantly African-American or of color, it kind of comes with the territory that you're going to see culture. But I think when you live in places like Alaska or other places where we do have a diverse community, but it's small comparatively, I think you have to work a little bit harder to acknowledge and like be seen and have your culture uplifted. And that's kind of the feeling I've always got with my work here in Alaska.
And jumping off of that, I wanted to talk about two of your businesses. The first is Emoja Co-working.
Yes.
Can you explain how a co-working and incubator building works and how you think it accomplishes the goals of supporting culture, collaboration, community, and events?
Yeah. So first and foremost, Emoja is Swahili for unity, and that was a big thing for me. And so we're a co-working space and a business incubator space and cultural incubator space, purposely located in Mountain View because it's diverse and there's a need there and the community is there. And so in those kind of co-working spaces, not only are you helping people start businesses, but you try to focus on like entrepreneurs of color, people who don't speak English, or just neighborhoods that have been historically like not represented. And so in our building, we try to not just start businesses, but also like uplift culture and infuse culture and language and like heritage in what we do to build community while we build our businesses.
Can you talk about some of the businesses that use Emoja?
Oh, yeah. So we give shout out. So, yeah. So we have Pacific Communities of Alaska. Love them. We have Legacy Painters Academy, Legacy Credit. We have Dr. Mendoza. He's an ESL doctor. He speaks English and Spanish. And so he does practice on site. We also have NAACP. So it's actually cool. We have a combination of for-profits and nonprofits who use the building, and they just kind of synergize together.
And the other business I'm curious about is Baby Vend, which is your company that stocks vending machines
Yes.
across the country with baby supplies. I'm curious about how that business got started and if you have any advice for Alaska entrepreneurs looking for a national footprint like that.
Yeah, so that business got started literally out of necessity. And my son doesn't like the story now because he's older, but it literally was started because he had a diaper blowout in the mall and I had to engineer a diaper out of random supplies. And so I was like, oh, this isn't going to happen. And so I just started thinking about the idea of families moving and needing supplies. And I think for Alaskan entrepreneurs who want a national footprint, I think the first thing I would just tell them is believing they can have a national footprint. And like getting a mentor or there's some support on like what it means to expand. So like if you want to expand out of state, I would say like start with one place and then like kind of work your way out to more. And just letting them know it's doable. Like you can't have a national presence.
And the Griot Hero Awards, it sounds like the top winner gets a lot of exposure. You know, they say they'll highlight the winners and try to get community members to support it. You have quite a large footprint
Yeah.
already, and I'm curious how you think more exposure to your businesses, how you think that would help you sort of as an entrepreneur.
Yeah, I think two things. So, like, I would love to, I guess, have that award, but I don't know if I want it necessarily for me personally. I love the idea of people nationally knowing about Alaska and our culture and our work and what we're doing. So for me, it would be amazing to have that support go to my nonprofit, you know, like help and amplify and make a bigger footprint there because eventually we want to be out of state. But just thinking outside of myself, I just love for people to just see Alaska and just get curious and be like, oh, there's a brown woman in Alaska. What else is there? And then maybe it'll like prompt them to be interested and learn more about us and just stop thinking like it's just dark and cold and all white. There's more here.
The deadline to vote for Jasmine Smith for the Griot Hero Award is June 30th. Meanwhile, parents in Anchorage have dozens of camps to choose from. The Alaska Botanical Garden has been sponsoring summer day camps for about 20 years. One new option on the schedule this year is an insect safari camp. Alaska Public Media's Tim Rocky went searching for bugs with campers last week and has this story.
Lunchtime just finished, and campers are busy. Some are using microscopes to get a closer look at insects, while others are coloring. Stacy Schreiner leads the education department at the Botanical Garden. She says that parents wanted to send their kids somewhere that could stay unplugged in the woods all afternoon.
If they are learning to love to be outside, to respect it, to be curious about it, to wonder, then that's what I want them to walk away with.
The Botanical Garden has camp offerings for kids from ages 5 to 15. Schreiner says that after last summer, parents asked for a week of camp centered around insects. 8-year-old Harbor Johnson says she learned about how worms can turn soil into compost.
So we learned about mosquitoes, and they like have like a saw on their nose, and they cut into our skin, and they spit on our skin, and it's so it doesn't, you don't feel it when they're biting you.
Stink bug.
Just stink one bug second. Oh, don't put a stink bug on me.
Counselors, or fairies, as the campers are told, hide plastic bugs throughout the botanical garden that kids find each morning. But some of the bugs are very real.
There's a big spider right there.
Oh, yeah.
We'll leave that spider there.
Some of the plastic bugs will begin a game that campers play, and others are just to help campers lose their fear of insects. Tara Neff and her family moved to Alaska from Texas 2 years ago. She says she hears all about what her daughter Vivian learned each day when she comes home from camp.
They learned about bad bugs, they learned about termites, and they drew wanted posters. We made copies for all of our friends so they can pass them out. She was very excited.
6-year-old Cecilia Ross made a wanted poster for a stink bug.
When they're scared, they make a stinky smell.
Okay, did you find any stink bugs here?
Yes, I found one right. I found one on the table and I picked it up.
Patrick Ryan has been helping lead the camp since he began working with the Botanical Garden nearly 20 years ago. He corrects Cecilia and teaches her that she's actually holding a birch shield bug, technically not a part of the stink bug family, but they still release an odor when they're squished. Ryan says the camps at the Botanical Garden help kids gain a naturalist intelligence about the forest around them.
I think there's just a kind of a spirit and a good feeling here of walking into a forest. Plus we have our cultivated gardens, but it's just a beautiful kind of relaxing place to be.
The summer camps and other programs put on by the Botanical Garden go toward keeping the space available for Alaskans year-round. In Anchorage, I'm Tim Rocky.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin and Jeremy Shea in Anchorage, Katie Anastas in Juneau, Sabine Pooks in Kasilof, and Riley Board in Kenai. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.